Good evening, America, and good afternoon, Australia. Welcome back to Radio Tony Everyday Business, and I'm your host, Tony Lontis. Just a reminder that you can hear us on the replay of the live show via the podcast. If you're listening on LinkedIn and Facebook and YouTube, welcome and thank you for tuning in today. You can find out information on all of our guests via radiotony.com, where you look under the co-host tab to find links to everyone that we speak to so that you can connect with them yourself. So today I wanted to start the show with my guest's favorite quote, which is, "If light is in your heart, you will find your way home," by Rumi. Now, Thamina Mughal is focused on amplifying the voices of life coaches and healers. And she's our gorgeous guest for today. And she's an author, blogger, content writer, and lives in Smyrna, Georgia. I hope I've got that right. She's a former teacher who retired early to pursue her passion for writing. And currently, she writes articles and content for life coaches and healers. But she didn't always do this. She's also written two books. Sadirazade's Daughters and Siddiqui Brothers in Cairo, and writes a blog called Behind and Beyond the Veil. For her, writing is the craft of storytelling, which enables her to enlighten others. Good afternoon, Thamina, and welcome to Radio Tony.
Hello, thank you very much.
It's a delight to have you on the show today, but I wanted to start at the beginning and talk about the fact that you your parents came to America before you were born, and you were actually born in Lansdale, Pennsylvania, the mm-hmm. daughter of immigrants who came from Uganda in 1972. Correct. And so mm-hmm. I wanted to talk to you about what that was like, having immigrant parents growing up in Pennsylvania.
Well, it actually was a really interesting experience because we were literally the first South Asian family in our town. And my mother kept the newspaper clipping from the local paper. So the local paper took a picture of my family, but my family were also refugees. The dictator yes. in 1972, Idi Amin, he expelled 50,000 Asians, and they were called the Ugandan Asians. And my family was a part of that diaspora. So they, through twists of fate, they ended up in Lansdale, Pennsylvania, and literally were the first South Asian family in the town, first Muslim family in the town. But what was really interesting is that the Lutheran church really helped us when we came to yes. the town. So I've always had a special place in my heart for the Lutheran church. But it was just really interesting growing up because you just, when you're growing up, you want to be a part of the culture that you live yes. in. So yeah. I was very American, but I had very limited access to Indian culture and really yeah. got as much as my parents and my aunts and uncles could instill in me. So it was really interesting having one culture at home and then going yeah. out into the world and having a slightly different culture, not completely different, but slightly different. So it was very interesting growing up and juggling that. So a lot of times I felt displaced, like not quite belonging yes. to one, but not quite belonging to another. But I just flowed through life just being me. That's all you can do.
Absolutely. So I'm thinking about being displaced from a country where your parents grew up, and they would have had no input into that whole immigration. They were just told to go, effectively, weren't they?
Pretty much, yeah. Mm-hmm. That yeah. They literally had a deadline that you have to be out of this country by this deadline. So there was just the frenzy of, my father had a wife and seven children at the time. So there was just frenzy of, okay, let's make sure we get everything together. We know where we're going and we're alive. And so I have a lot of respect for my parents because they didn't talk about that much. They didn't talk about, and my aunts and uncles too, they didn't talk about the emotions that they had being displaced like that and trying to pack up your family and keep your family safe. They never really talked about that because they're of the old school mindset that if something has to be done, you just do it. And then you just
do it
forward. So it was really, I feel like it was a gift in a sense to grow up like that because it teaches you a resilience. I learned resilience through example. I learned strength and fortitude through example. So I'm very grateful for those lessons.
I can't imagine how your parents with seven children have to leave everything they've ever known and end up in a foreign country where Muslim culture and religion is not something that Americans would have been very familiar with back in 1972. So a tough call for them, and well done. And I'm glad that you landed in America and that you were given safety and allowed to grow up relatively without violence. In talking about Muslim religion, did you suffer from any racial stigmas or bullying that you remember as you were growing up, Samina?
Not so much about my Muslimness because a lot of people hadn't really heard of it, but more so from my South Asian background because literally people saw things in black and white. So...
Yes.
Like I was a little tricky for people to figure out sometimes because I had the brown skin, but my hair was straight and my nose was pointy. So what do you do with that? It doesn't quite fit what you normally see. So I grew up with, if someone was mad at me, the first thing they would call me is the N-word. And, you know, so that happened enough. It didn't happen too many times, but it happened enough. And then there would be some sort of comment related to my brownness. And my favorite one, my personal favorite, was being asked if I owned a 7-Eleven, like those kinds of things. So like that's,
no way.
Yeah. I won't say that that happened all the time, but it did happen. It did happen.
I hope that one day we get to see a world where we don't stigmatize people or label them with a general. We should always be humans first, no matter our color, our background, our ethnicity, our sexuality. We should just be human first. When we can get to that point, humanity will have humanity will be a wonderful place. So in that environment, you obviously had lots of family around you that was somewhat of a protection. So what did your parents end up doing for work when they arrived? How did they manage all of that with children to feed and clothe?
Well, my parents had a very specific partnership. So my father was the breadwinner and my mother was the homemaker. So my father was a skilled worker. He was a skilled blacksmith by trade. Yes. So when he came to this country, So when he came to this country, he was a welder. So he, you know, so I
easily
came from
employable.
Yes. So I came from a working class background. He actually literally could walk to work from the house, which was really nice for him. And so his job was to work and be the breadwinner. And my mother had the task of raising the eight kids as best as she could. So so it was a very traditional partnership in that way. And
awesome.
Yeah. And so, I mean, just through their example, you know, my dad working hard outside the home, my mother working hard inside the home. Like, to be honest with you, my mother didn't sit still much. And even as I got older, I noticed sometimes if we were about to go somewhere and she had 5 minutes, like let's say she had to wait for me for 5 minutes in that 5 minutes, she would cut up some fruit or something. And then, it would take her longer than 5 minutes. And then that by that time I would be ready and I would just tell her, can you just sit still for 5 minutes? But I mean, if you have 8 kids, you're not really sitting still. And they're all
Yeah,
in
agreed.
different age groups. Like the age gap between me and my oldest sibling is 12 years. So like you,
Oh,
yeah. So
wow. So
she
you're
had kids
really the
in different,
baby.
yeah. So she had kids in different stages of life. So you can't sit down too much.
No, which has its own challenges because I'm imagining you're the baby and she would have had a whole range of teenagers and then probably older children leaving home and you're the baby and there's that big, yeah, wow, that's a lot for her to coordinate and manage. So as the youngest in the family, were you encouraged to do whatever you wanted by virtue of now having that relative freedom of living in America?
I don't know if I was encouraged to do what I wanted, because there were still custom and rules that you had to follow. But I had it 10 times easier than my older sisters. I think, like, honestly, by the time I got to my teenage years, my parents were just satisfied that I was still alive and I wasn't getting into any trouble. So I think that they had less of an eye on me. And then I, like things and things that they had to fight for, I did without a second thought. So I'm very grateful for my position in the family. I tell my oldest sister all the time, I wouldn't trade places with you for anything. And because I basically I got to do what I wanted, pretty much. Not like I said, not all the time, because I did find things to rebel against, but I did what I wanted pretty much.
We all do. We all do. In some of your information, you call yourself a cultural hybrid. What do you mean by that, Samina?
I really mean that I am a product of more than one culture, and I am an amalgamation of more than one culture, because at one time I had difficulty with that because society tells you have to choose something. And many times it's either one thing or the other. And I never wanted to choose one thing or the other because there is so much I love about Western culture. But then there's so much that I love about Eastern culture. So why can't I take the best of both, incorporate that into my life? So
Agreed.
that's what I've done. And that's why I refer to myself as a cultural hybrid, because I feel like I have the independent spirit of the West, but an awareness of community of the East. So I feel like I have a really good balance of that.
Absolutely. So I'm curious to know, because you've written the books, did you write as a child?
Not that much, to be honest with you. I was an avid reader. I was really an avid reader, and that's how pretty much all writers start. I was an avid reader. I got lost in the world of books, and I read so much. And so I did some things here and there, in elementary school and high school a little bit, and even in college. But it was very undercover. I took fiction writing classes in college, and then it was always in the back of my mind. But then when I was teaching, and I was teaching a unit where I had students write their own stories and like write their own Arabian Nights story, I just thought to myself, as much as you love this, why don't you do it? Like, and so I and that started this writing journey. And I think a lot of times I didn't write because, like many artists, I have a thing about perfection. So that perfection sometimes hinders me. So I feel like when I was younger, I didn't write as much as I could have or should have, because I was just so almost like, if it can't be perfect, don't bother, which is such such a faulty premise. But
Absolutely.
that's where I was.
But a lot of us struggle with that perfectionism trait. I know I've struggled with it for most of my life, thinking that if it's not perfect, it's not good enough, when in fact, the just showing up and just doing something or just having action behind something, it's okay. And I know that those were lots of the thoughts that went through my head when I first started writing my book, that it has to be a certain way with it. And rather than allowing the creation just to flow and the words just to flow. So I want to talk a little bit about your first book. Do you want to tell our listeners about your journey into that first book?
Scheherazade's Daughters, that just unfolded over time. Like I said, I thought that, why don't I do this? Because I love this so much. I've taught it. I know the conventions of an Arabian Nights story. And initially, I was thinking about my oldest niece, Tara, and her birthday was coming up, and I was going to write a story where the main character's name was Tara, and some of her characteristics reminded me of her. And so as I started to write the story, I don't know, she never got it as a present, but she knows that she inspired it. But then I just kept going, and I decided, because I have eight nieces and nephews and four of them are female, so I just decided to write more stories that with their names. And then and I can't even tell you the inspiration for all the but all these different characters and their stories just started coming into my head. And yeah, and but one wasn't my own creation. One was from the original tales, and I wrote a story from her point of view because I felt like she got a really bad rap in the original tales, and I felt like, she was portrayed as a villain when, in so many ways, she was actually a victim. And in response to being made a victim, she took these extreme actions. But in the story, she's really villainized. So one of my characters was inspired by her, and the story is told from her point of view. And then four of the characters were inspired by me and my sisters. And then I don't know, it just one character was inspired by my father. And so so different people in my life showed up in these stories, and then the different stories just evolved and took on a life of their own.
And rolled
One of the
together.
stories, yeah, one of the stories came from a dream I had. And so yeah, I turned that into a story. So
And then
they
they all
just.
roll together to this wonderful story of genies and fairies and wonderful women from the East who have these extraordinary journeys of spirit and mind and heart. And it has a strong female-centric woven through it, doesn't? And that was important to you to have strong female stories within that book.
Yes, absolutely. Because I feel like in the original tales, as much as I love them, there weren't, for me, there weren't enough strong female characters who were intelligent. There were some, but a lot of them were just like evil sorceresses or just evil wives, and human beings and women especially are a lot more complex than that. So I really
Definitely.
wanted to show strong, independent, intelligent women who had agency and who really all they wanted, like even though those stories weren't interrelated, all they wanted was to be free to live the life that they chose for themselves. And so that is the common theme throughout that. But the last story is a little bit of a departure from that. Even though the beginning there is this fairy who is fascinated by a merchant. That story is more my father's story. That was kind of my homage to my father. But there is that strong fairy who has all this power, but she's like enamored with this humble merchant. So
Yes.
yeah, so the stories run the gamut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that you felt it was important for your nieces to have strong female stories that they could read?
Yes, I did, not only just for my nieces, but my cousins and just South Asian women in particular. I just thought that was really like, and particularly Muslim women. And then I thought it was also important for people who weren't from a South Asian Muslim background, because many times in literature, in film, you have a single story. You have this story of an oppressed woman in a veil. And even the character who's a victim in my story, she's not an oppressed woman in a veil. She's, you know, she actually takes revenge on the person who victimizes her. So, I mean, even though that's not the most powerful display of agency, she still has, even in her victimhood, she still has an agency. So I thought it was really important to portray female Muslim characters in that way, and they are diverse characters, and so I really want to show through my fiction writing in particular that there's more than one story in the Muslim world, particularly where women are concerned. Not everybody's conservative, not everybody's religious. It's just like anybody else in the world. There are complexities in spirituality and belief, and so I wanted to portray all of that. So I thought it was important for not just people in my community, but people outside my community as well.
So, Samina, is it okay if we touch on that whole for Muslim women wearing a veil and the different thought around that? So obviously you don't wear a veil, but I'm sure that you know other Muslim women who do. Can we just quickly delve into that a little bit, the reasons why and the reasons why not?
Well, some women, they want to be pious and they want to follow the tenets of the religion, so it comes from that place. But then other women actually see it as a form of expression and a form of freedom, because they get to choose. You know, I they're choosing, okay, I don't want to show you this part of me because I choose not to. I choose not to. I choose to save that for the people closest to me. And some people look at it like that. And then for me, I know, for me personally, I know other women feel this way, that one, I don't feel that I need to do that to be closer to God. And then the other thing is, the whole point of that is for modesty and for you to kind of just be humble and not stand out. And I feel in a country like this, you can still be modest while wearing that, but I feel like you stand out more. It's like, especially the way I grew up, now not so much. I'm actually really happy for the younger girls coming up. If they choose to wear that, they're not standing out as much. But the way I grew up in the 80s, 70s and 80s in Pennsylvania, if I wore that, I would have stood out.
You would have.
And so I just thought it's so counter to what the original intent of it is. So I really feel like that's a personal choice. And so women have diverse reasons for that personal choice. And so yeah, it really depends who you
And
talk to. Yeah.
I was going to say, Samina, do you feel that the Muslim women actually do have that choice in the majority of cases? You don't feel that? I know years ago that I used to see a woman wearing a veil, and for me, it triggered an instant that woman is oppressed. But as I've grown and talked to more and more with Muslim women, I realise that there's a whole range of reasons that sit behind that decision. So, I guess the question is, do you, from your perspective as a Muslim woman, do you feel that there is enough choice for Muslim women? Do you, obviously, as with any other society, there are going to be those outliers of women who feel that they have no other choice. But do you feel that, generally speaking, they have that choice now?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think it really depends on where they're from. Because you have to follow the culture of where you're from. Like in Saudi Arabia, for example, you're probably not going to walk around like I am right now. And that's, you kind of don't have a choice. I actually had a friend from Saudi Arabia, and she said that you cover yourself up when you're going to wherever it is you're going to, but then when you get there, you can take it off. Because she showed me a picture of herself in a dress, and her dress was like above the knee. I said, "Wait a minute, you're wearing a dress?" And she said, ugh. She just rolled her eyes and she said, "Like, it's not what you see. It's not always just what you see on TV." So there are, I feel like there are so many diverse stories in the world. So I think there are diverse stories following that as well. Like I know for me personally, how I grew up, it was always a choice. So I can only go by that. But other families, other cultures are a little different. So to be honest with you, I would say it's maybe 50-50, depending on where you go in the world.
Well, that's good to know. So we now go on to the second book that you wrote, which was a novella called Siddiqui. Have I just pronounced that right? Brothers in
Siddiqui.
Cairo?
Siddiqui Brothers in Cairo, yes.
Siddiqui. Beautiful word. Siddiqui is just in makes me envision the whole Eastern Asian. It's beautiful. And so that was a novella, and it's a story about brothers in Cairo. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit more about that story for us, Samina?
So what happened with that is that I actually created those characters in Scheherazade's Daughters. So they were first introduced in the story Izania's Adventures in the House of Wisdom. And Izania is a female scientist in the House of Wisdom. And she's brilliant, but she can't get the break that she deserves because she's a woman. And so she struggles with that in the story, but then she knows the Siddiqui brothers. And the Siddiqui brothers are just, in that story, in many ways, they were comic relief. And they were just these, like, they were, I love to subvert tropes in anything that I write. So they were a juxtaposition of these brilliant scientists, but they were hard partiers. And they were just very enlightened in their thinking. And so they were kind of like these like hedonist scientists because they're astronomers and astrologers. So they just have this wide view of the universe because they know that the universe is infinite. And so they have a lot of fun with it. So they have a lot of fun with that, and they have a lot of fun with her. And they actually, there's a scene where she actually is being really stubborn with the man that she loves, and they set her straight. And the way they do it is really comical. But I really love them. I actually really fell in love with these characters. And like I don't know how it was three instead of just one man, but they were just like these. I don't know. I just like the idea of these three brothers in this time just doing their thing. And then what happens is at the end of that story, and this is actually historically accurate, there was a house in Baghdad in the 13th century, but then the Mongols came and conquered the city and they destroyed the House of Wisdom. And so the legend has it that the rivers ran black with the ink from all the books they destroyed. So there was that legend. And so the Siddiqui brothers are there witnessing that. And they actually cry at the end of that story because they're witnessing that. So because they're a part of that, they have to find, they're scholars, they have to find a new place to study. So
Definitely.
historically, the next up and coming center for learning was Cairo. So they ended up in
Yes,
Cairo.
in
And
Cairo.
so they're basically like, technically, this is the golden age of Islam, and it was a progressive time in many ways. But the irony of the Siddiqis is that they may be too progressive for the time that they're in. And so they butt heads with people a lot. And but they still have that theme that's in all of my work, that they want to live their lives how they want, but they want that for other people. And I really enjoyed that it was men who wanted that, and they wanted that for the women in their lives. So, and you don't see that. You don't really see that too often in Muslim fiction. And that does exist. Like everything else in the world, that does exist. And I wanted to show that. And I really just wanted to play with them, not only wanting freedom for themselves, but wanting it for other people, especially women. And there are several instances in that book where you see their progressive attitudes towards women. Like the oldest brother falls in love with a courtesan and wants to marry a courtesan. And then they take on a corrupt imam. And there's another female scientist that they champion in Cairo. So basically it's just them like just having fun, butting heads with society, and doing their thing. So that's where that came from.
Fantastic. So the two books and the writing the fiction then led to something else that you discovered about your writing, which caused you to sort of pivot, didn't it? So what was that, Samina?
So when I decided to write full time, I played around in different niches, because like I'm multi-passionate and I have a lot of interests. Like I have real expertise in education, particularly in language acquisition. So I wrote in that, and then I also write sociopolitical commentary. I'm very passionate about culture and politics. So in my personal blog, I played around with that. But then I found that because I worked with a lot of healers and life coaches informally in the past, really like helping people. As a teacher, I serve. That's what I did, and I feel like that's what I was put on this earth to do, is to serve. And so, so I started working with life coaches, and then in my personal blog, I started talking about experiences I was having in real time. And then I thought that because we're all on our personal growth journey, and that's lifelong. And so as I came to certain points in my personal growth journey, I thought this could be helpful to people. And so I wrote about that. So I found that in writing in all these different niches, that my greatest passion was in personal development. And then as I was working with life coaches, I just thought, I have this unique talent and I want to help life coaches serve others. So I can, this is how I use my unique talent to serve others. And I also like the idea of being behind the scenes as well. So I don't mind being in the forefront with my fiction, but like supporting life coaches, I don't mind being in the background and just helping, helping life coaches who are busy really get their message out. And so because their main purpose is to work one-on-one with people. And so, so I want to help them help other people. And so writing their content for them is something that I really want to do, and I feel it would be a really, really valuable way to serve. How that's how
And
I
the thing
pivoted,
is,
yeah.
I'm not sure that all of our for those people that have not engaged with a life coach before, they have such a positive impact on so many realms within your life. And there are coaches for just a diverse range of things. So you can have business coaches, you can have life coaches, you can have spiritual coaches, you can have coaches for all sorts of things, from sales to what have you. And they have such a powerful part in helping humans reach the next level or be their best selves. I know for me, all sorts of different healers have helped me along my life journey, each of them different and unique. And I think as humans, we forget sometimes that we have the opportunity to try out all sorts of different healing modalities and all sorts of different coaching ways to help us get there. And because we're all unique, it's about finding that one coach that really makes the difference in your life. So you write for these very niched, special group of people, and you're passionate about getting the information that they teach and coach and help humanity with. Is your writing and freelance business has now pivoted full time into specifically writing for life coaches and healers, hasn't it, Samina?
Yes. I deliberately chose to work with just that
Yes.
population. But I recently I did do some work for an editor. So anybody who writes books, I have a soft spot in my heart for anybody who writes books. But my main clientele is life coaches and healers. And like I said, that was very deliberate because I'm so comfortable with personal development and I'm so comfortable with life coaching. And to be honest with you, aspects of what I did as a teacher, were life coaching. So, so I'm really comfortable with that niche and I'm very comfortable with personal development. And I'm also an excellent collaborator. So I know that I can collaborate effectively with people and get their message out. And I'm also at the base of it all, I'm great with words. So,
I was just going to say,
yeah.
and that's the thing that people need to understand, that it's the words and the storytelling that connect one human with another. And that's where the power of your writing comes in. Sabina, what sort of things do you write? What sort of content do you write for life coaches and healers? Is
Basically
it just
what
blogs or is it emails
oh
or
oh
what sort of work does
I write a variety of content. So I can do blogs, I can do emails, newsletters. I recently did social media posts for someone. And I can even do ghostwriting for books. So I'm really open to that. So I write a variety of content.
Fantastic. So if they're a really busy life coach or healer and they want to write about something, but they just haven't got time, you can actually work with them and ghostwrite on their behalf. So it's going to be their book. You're just going to do the writing for them.
Yes.
And
Absolutely.
so do you have a process around ghostwriting,
Well, essentially what it is, it's just a bigger macrocosm of what I do with the article writing. I give you access to me. Like with an article, you get a brainstorming session with me. You get you get an hour with me. But depending on the project, you would get several brainstorming sessions with me, and you would tell me, okay, this is the story I want to tell. Help me tell it. And then we would go back and forth as to what the best way to tell that story is. So that's how that would work. So you would get some one-on-one brainstorming time with me. You would get, you get access to me through email, and it really is a collaboration. Like let's say,
I
again,
was
it's
just going to
depending on
say
the project. Like
it's
let's
a
say
very
I do a draft of a
yep
chapter, I'll send it to you, and then you tell me, okay, I like this, but I want to see this, and then you give it back to me, and we go from there. So I feel like that piece is super important, because I may be writing it for you, but it's still your voice. It's your voice and your story, and I want to tell the story that you want to tell.
So
That's my role.
I was going to say, so that's where your passion and love comes from, isn't it, Samina? You really like to get in and find out the essence of the person that you're working for and be able to convey that into words that they would normally use. And you do that through this lovely collaborative approach to writing. It's a wonderful idea for busy business people to have a content writer, and certainly valuable in this day and age when that content can be used across websites, blogs, newsletters, social media, and a whole range of things. It's more and more people are seeking the expertise of content writers. And so for you to pick that niche that you are particularly passionate about just brings great results for the people that you work with.
I just I have a way, and I've always had a way of like using precise wording, because I was a language acquisition expert. I used to teach language, so I know the nuances of language. So I'm very good at finding the right word or right words.
Samina, you can work with anyone across the world, can't you? It's not, you're not just US based, but you can work with anyone across the planet, really.
Absolutely. I mean, we have Zoom, we have email.
Email.
I have no problem with that.
How much fun do you have writing content for healers?
Oh, I love it, because there are so many healing modalities, and I learn about new ones all the time. Like, I just learned about theta healing a few days ago. I'd heard of it, and I came to find
What is
out my
that?
cousin. Oh, theta healing? It's like Reiki. But it combines, I would say it combines Reiki with quantum healing, and it really works on a subconscious level. And so whatever subconscious programs that you have, the theta healer goes in and really reworks that, and whatever specific issues that you have surrounding that, like that gets kind of erase, but then it gets replaced with something else. So let's say, like, on a really basic level, if you have fear of starting new things, that gets taken out and replaced with excitement about trying new things, like that kind of thing. So I just learned about that, and she actually did a session on me, which was amazing. Like, I let her work on me, because she's my cousin and I know her. So but I learned about that. So And then I knew about tea leaf reading before, but I'd never had it done. And then through my Facebook group, I came in contact with a tea leaf reader, and I wrote an article for her. And I basically wrote it from the point of view, because I really couldn't see how you can see someone's life in tea leaves. Like, it's tea leaves. So basically, the article was a skeptic's, a skeptic's experience with tea leaf reading. So I had a lot of fun with that. So not only do I get to learn about different healing modalities, but you get to, like, everybody has their own unique style with everything, and it's no different with healing. Everybody has their unique style of healing. So, it's really great to learn about a particular modality, but then also the healer behind that modality and how they bring their unique talents into that modality. So that's really exciting for me.
Yeah, I'll bet. Because there's so many different things that you can get that will help you. I know the power of the subconscious, and I did a whole series of interviews last year with one of my friends who we talked about quantum physics and healing and working with the subconscious mind. I had no idea the power that comes from working at that level and replacing those limiting beliefs or the things that hold us back. Sometimes we don't even realize that that's the thing that's holding us back. We don't even realize that behind our everyday persona is this little nagging thought that I'm not good enough or I'm too scared to try that, or anything else that sits back in that subconscious that you don't consciously think about on a day-to-day basis, but it's always in the back there controlling the way that you live your life. And once you get rid of it, it just makes life that much better, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I've actually, it's like what you were saying, there were some limiting beliefs that I had that I didn't even realize that I had. And
Yes.
I actually consciously addressed them. And I've just seen the rewards of that, of just addressing that and moving it. And it's amazing stuff.
It
Like I
is.
said, your personal growth journey is just ongoing,
Yes.
and you discover new things about
Yes.
yourself, like almost on a daily basis.
Yes. I agree. And the power that you can get from the way that you think is limitless. So
Absolutely.
you can continue to grow and change and evolve and understand, and it just makes you that much better of a human being. It changes the way that you react in certain circumstances. You're less likely to be triggered to be angry. There's just so many positives for working with that level of healer. And there's also the equivalent life coaches who work in that area as well. And they're just powerful in changing the status quo. So I'm incredibly excited that you work in that realm and write in that realm and create content in that realm, because the more that we do that, the more people read and understand and listen to shows and hear the content, the more we as humans will hopefully evolve, which is what we really are aiming for, isn't it, Samina?
Absolutely. And
So
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
you go.
No, I was just
I
saying, if
was
I
just
can be a part of, I love being part of someone's learning experience and someone broadening their
Yes.
horizons. That's part of the reason I became a teacher. So doing this work, I get to do it on a larger scale. So that's pretty exciting for me.
Yeah. So it does actually link back with all your teaching and educational experience, because in effect, working with life coaches and healers is a very educative experience, because they're teaching you something new that you didn't know about before. Like you said, with the tea leaf reader, I've actually never thought about why they do what they do, but I'm quite sure you could now tell me why tea leaf readers do what they do and why it's important to them.
The one that I worked with, like she had this business where she was selling tea, and she had this intuitive capability, and she started to enjoy it. And so, like she saw that she had a real gift for it. And
Yes.
there are techniques that you follow, and she learned that, but she had that. She had that innate gift anyway. She had that innate
Yes.
intuition. So
Yeah.
she just felt like this was just a modality that spoke to her, because a lot of people were born with a certain level of intuition, and then they
I
connect
was
with,
just going to ask you about that.
So they're born. I think we're actually, to be honest with you, we're all born with a certain level of
I
intuition.
would agree.
Because I feel like if you're a mother, especially, like mothers in particular have intuition when it comes to their children. So
They do.
it just is like you and twins have intuition when it comes
Yes.
to each other. So I think we all have a certain level of intuition. Some of us just use it more than others. And then once we recognize our intuition, sometimes we just connect with a modality that allows us to enhance our intuition or to use it to its best possible
Yeah.
capacity. So, and that's different for everybody. Like for me, I'm a Reiki healer. So that was
Yes.
the modality that spoke to me because
I
I'm
love
very,
Reiki.
So I'm very because I'm very energy based. Like
Yes.
I'm in tune with other
Yes.
people's energies. I can read other people's
Yes.
energies. So
Yes.
Reiki just spoke to me. So
Yeah.
but yeah, like I mean, and I can feel different energies too, which is really interesting. Like I can feel energy in my hands and I can feel other people's energy. So it really like you have this innate knowing of what your intuition is, and then
Yes.
you just follow what speaks to you most.
I mean, I actually think that it's a bit like a muscle that I think that we're all born with it. And I think if we're given the opportunity to understand and know about it, then it continues to grow and grow. Whereas, like any muscle, if you don't use it and you don't grow it, then you tend to lose it. I find it, I have met some intuitive men, but I find that the feminine energy is predominant around tapping into your intuition. I wish that more men were encouraged to feel the energy of their own lives and those around them. But again, that comes back to that whole society conversation about how we treat men and women and what we see as a feminine or masculine energy. Whereas I like to think of humans as unique humans with human traits, not feminine versus masculine. And I really do believe that if we had more men understanding and tapping into their intuition, then that would be just an amazing thing.
Yeah, I think also it's in how you frame it to men too, because
Yes.
like because I think a lot of men prize going with your gut, and that's pretty much what
Yes.
intuition is. So I think
Absolutely.
sometimes it's just in how you frame it.
It's the language and the words that we put around it, isn't it? That's exactly what you do, Samina, is you put language and words around concepts that make them easy to understand for people and present your life coach or healer in a way that connects them with more people. Yeah?
And I think that's really what it's all about. I think in any vocation, but in life coaching especially, like
Yes.
you really need to connect with people on a deep level. So,
Yes.
I like to help people with that. So.
Yeah. Oh, Samina, we are just about out of time. It's been really delightful talking to you today. I'm very appreciative that you took the time to talk to us today on Radio Tony. For anyone who wants to know, both on radiotony.com and on the BBS station site, you will find links to Samina's books. You will find links on to her website so you can connect with her. If you're a coach or a healer looking for someone to write first class content for your blogs, newsletters, email, social media, please reach out to Samina. She has a wealth of knowledge and understanding, not just in the education, but also spiritual life coaching and teaching. So she's got a broad range of experience that will help get the content written in a way that's most useful for you. So just a reminder, jump onto radiotony.com. You'll also find it under Radio Tony on the BBS site. The links to Samina, how to connect with her, where to find her books. They're also available on Amazon, and I encourage you today to jump on and check them out because they're wonderful tales that she's written from a fiction standpoint. Samina Miguel, thank you so much for being on Radio Tony Everyday Business today. It's been a pleasure. And that, my friend, is all we have for this week. Thanks, Samina.
Thank you very much.
And we will see you all next week, same time. And over to you now, TJ. Bye, everyone.